9802 Real 1.
Mr. Richardson, Real 1. When and how did you join the Navy, please?
I joined in October 1941, and I joined at HMS Collingwood in Fareham.
You're telling me that you were called up?
I called up. Conscript.
Why? What was your reaction when you were called up? Were you just resigned or happy to be called up or what?
Well, most of my pals had gone into the services and you thought, well, about time I got in as well. And as I say, conscript was on, so that was it. You accepted the fact that you'd be called up when you was of age.
And the Navy was your first preference, was it?
Yes.
What was the training like?
With a basic 10-week training, which involved being kitting up and medical inoculations, vaccinations and such like. Quite a bit of square bashing. And then on to seamanship. Learning the parts of the ship and what it involved in coming to anchor or lowering the whaler or the cutter. Methods of carrying out orders.
How much could you learn in 10 weeks?
Very, very little. In fact, I don't know whether we even knew the sharp end from the blunt when we first went aboard.
How were you treated as a new conscript?
What, in the training establishment?
Yes.
Oh, that wasn't too bad in the training establishment. But you just had to do as you were told. And that was it. And if my memory serves me right, the first 2 weeks, or I don't know, it was 2 weeks or more, you weren't allowed out. You were in uniform, but you had to learn to wear your uniform properly before you was allowed out. But I can't remember whether it was a fortnight or whether it was a month. But otherwise, I had a reasonable time there.
You were trained to be a seaman, were you?
You're trained to be a seaman. And when I joined up, I got on the train to go down, and there was about 10 local lads all joined the train together. And so as we went into Fareham, we then went into the barracks at Collingwood, and we was put into huts as a class. Class comprised of about 30, I think, of which 50% of it was all local lads, or from round this area.
Round Grimsby area?
Grimsby area, as far as Scunthorpe, and there was a couple from all, and but it was all mainly from this area, because as you came in off the train, so they just put the class together and put them in huts. Didn't break them up, you see. So as I say, 50% of them would be local lads. In fact, I have a photograph somewhere of a group of us, and I think you can nearly pick them out, the local lads on it. As I say, there was 4 here from Grimsby to start with. On the whole, I think I had a reasonable time in training. It wasn't that tough. It got tougher later on.
In what way?
Well, in various barracks later on in my service career. In discipline, and discipline was there in the first place. But as you began to get used to it, so it became harder. You was made to do it more. You couldn't have an excuse and say, I didn't know. You had to know by that time. But you could get away with it in the first spell.
So, how soon did you go to your first ship?
Well, I left. We got a week's leave after 10 weeks training. We then went back, and we was based in a camp in a wood, in Tinness Nuts, outside Fareham. I can't remember the name of the place now. Then waiting there to be drafted. A first draft kit I got in the camp, and you can imagine it was winter time, it was mud up to the eyebrows, was called Party Bonus. Now, how many was in this draft, I don't know, but there was quite a lot in it.
It was called Party Bonus. What does that mean exactly?
Well, I did. Well, we got this draft chit, and we got a week's leave. And we came home, and when we went back, that was over the Christmas, and we came back, the Party Bonus draft was cancelled. I did find out later that we was actually due to go to Singapore. But of course Singapore was on the verge of falling. Had the party gone, I think we should have arrived just in time for the collapse. But for some reason, I mean, you weren't always told things, you were just given orders to carry out. And so the draft was cancelled. My next draft chit after that was for HMS Cairo.
What kind of ship were you looking forward to being posted to, if any?
You had no choice.
But if you had had a choice, what would you have preferred?
Well, I don't really know. I don't think I'd any. Never having been to sea before, I had no idea. I knew about trawlers from home, of course, but beyond that, I didn't. A ship was a ship, whether it was a destroyer, frigate, or a battler. It was all the same as far as I was concerned.
Where did you pick Cairo up?
Well, they then transferred us back into Pompey Barracks. And we was put onto a train and we were sent to Plymouth. And we picked the Cairo up in Plymouth.
Was she a Plymouth ship?
I'm not sure on that point. She was mainly manned by a lot of London, the London Arranars. And she'd done just finishing off a major refit, of which they'd put on what was then the latest, the radar, and we'd had some of the guns altered. So she was actually made. She was originally a 6-inch cruiser. There was 4 C-class cruisers, of which is the book written by the Valiant Quartet, which gives the history of the 4. She was built about 1919. The 4 6-inch mountings were taken off and 4 twin mountings of 4.7s put in their place. The multiple pom-pom and Orlikans. She had 2 torpedo tubes, port and starboard, that was 4 torpedoes altogether, and they were removed. So she was made totally into an ACAC ship.
What was she like to live on from the crew's point of view?
Very uncomfortable. She was built, I think, in the first place, as I say, a 6-inch cruiser and a crew of about 250. But with the addition of radar, twin mountains which double the amount of gun crews required, plus the Orlikans and the pom-pom and other equipment, all increased the size of the ship's company, but it didn't increase the size of the deck, the mess deck spaces. The ship was still the same size, and from about 250 we went to 370. So the mess decks themselves, the seamen's mess decks, you were very tightly packed, very uncomfortable. I mean, if you got a seat at the mess table, you were lucky.
What did you do otherwise?
Just stand or sit on the floor. Hammock space, as you know, is 7 foot, I think, by 18 inches. And the hammocks were in 3 layers. on the mess deck itself, of which you lowered the mess deck table so you could get three layers in. Now you can imagine that in a space, well, imagine a space like this. And there's an average of 20 or over to a mess. There was one, two, three. I think there was 10 Siemens messes. So that made 100 in the Siemens mess. 4 out of the Siemens mess, going towards the cable lockers, was the boys' mess. And we had boys on board. There was in charge, the leading seaman club swinger was in charge of those.
Club swinger?
PTI instructor. Clubs, he was called.
Why was he called that?
Well, swinging the Indian club. In fact, I believe the badge, if my home is two cross clubs for the PTI instructor. That's where he got his nickname, clubs, from.
You were saying about the three layers of hammocks, which was the most popular position to be in, top, middle or bottom?
Hammocks weren't allowed to be slung at night until 9 o'clock. And of course the senior hands had the first privilege. You got what was left over. And if there wasn't any room left, then you found space somewhere down the passageways. Or anywhere you could get.
What were your duties aboard the Cairo?
Well, I was a seaman, which was working on the upper deck. And as regards at sea, I was communication number to the range taker above the ADP. The ADP is the air defence position. The range taker to the guns is above that, of which I was communication number. Andy known orders from the range taking officer down to the TS station, which is the transmitting station, of which they had a kind of computer, but it was a very Heath Robinson type of thing, which worked out the distance to the target, elevation, training, and also the levels between the height of the guns on the ship itself. So the four turrets, when they fired all together onto one spot. And this was worked out from the TS table down in the transmitting station back to the guns as laying and training.
So this was your action station?
Yes.
What kind of messing did they have on board?
Canteen messing.
Did that suit you?
Well, a canteen messing, you're allowed 1 6 months a day to feed a man. And the leading hand of the mess had a book of chits. And in the morning, he wrote out the order for his potatoes. Veg was mainly tin, fresh was very scarce, and meat. And anything else that was required. Tea, sugar, milk. Milk was, of course, condensed tinned. And then you drew these supplies. You brought them back to the mess, and the mess cooks, generally two members detailed off as mess cooks, they got the dinner together, whatever you're going to make of it. Generally it was a stew, or possibly you get a tray and stew and put an awning on top, which was a pastry cover. And then you took it to the galley, and the galley cooked it for you. Now, at the end of the month, the number of men in the mess and the 1 6 months was reckoned up and then balanced against what the item cost or not, I don't know, but it was balanced against what it cost. And if it was over, you'd overdrawn, then you had to pay out your own pocket. If you was underdrawn, you drew it as mess savings. And the mess then divided the savings amongst themselves, how much it was. But generally, it only amounted to a shilling or two. And if you was over it, it was generally a shilling or two over.
What about rum rations?
You're not allowed to draw your rum ration until you were 20. I went in at 19. Well, I was turned 19, I should say. And I'll be 20 in the May as I drew my first top. But until you're 20, you're classified as temperance. Or under... You're classified as underage up to 20. After 20, if you don't want your top, you draw threepence a day. And you're registered on your card as temperance. If you draw your grog, you're registered as G. And you draw your top. The leading hand of the mess would go and draw the rum ration for the mess, the number of men he was drawing for, and then he dished it out from there.
If you were temperance, could you still draw the rum and then sell it for more than threepence?
No. It was a crime. Now, you mustn't... You were entitled to your tot. Now, once you got your tot, you either drunk it, and if you didn't want it, you had to pour it over the side or down the scuppers. It was a crime to give anybody a tot. But it was done. Because on the lower deck, you could buy anything or any favour with either sippers or gulpers or a tot of rum, depending on the favour you were asking.
What were sippers and gulpers?
Sippers, you only got a mouthful. Gulpers, you got two good mouthfuls. And the tot, of course, you got the lot. If you wanted to, if you were a guard duty or some duty you've got, and you said to a bloke, would he do as me duty for us? I want to go ashore instead, or something like that. If you was watch ashore, of course. He'd say, well, it'll cost you a tot. Or it'll cost you gulpers. And he'd do it for you. No money passed. But all sorts of favours like that, you could buy with your rum ration.
And all this was strictly illegal?
It's strictly illegal.
But everybody did it?
Oh, it was done. They knew it was done, but it was impossible to catch anybody doing it. That's the point. And nobody on the mess deck was going to say anything. But there was more people lost their ranks and rates through fiddling with rum than anything. The rum bosun, I do know one ship it happened on. The rum is made up, is neat rum, at 11 o'clock. That is for chiefs and petty officers. It's then watered 2-1, and the ratings draw it at 12 o'clock. Now, you can't always tell the exact quantity he wants, because some people might be out the ship, or away, or anything like that, or leave, or anything like that. You never an exact count. So it was generally some to spare. Well, what he was doing was, there was an officer's cabin nearby, where he issued it from, and he got a can fixed underneath the wash basin, so that when he poured it down, it caught it underneath. Well, he got caught. Well, he was reduced to ranks. He lost 15 years good conduct and his chief petty officer's rank. The other fiddles was saving your rum issue, which again was illegal, and bottling it. And smuggling the bottle ashore and flogging it in the pubs. A bottle would generally fetch about £1, if you could get it ashore. Because £1 was a lot of money.
But you were searched before you went on shore?
Not necessarily a hand search, but you were watched. I mean, if somebody walked ashore with a bulging pocket with a bottle in, it was rather obvious. It was spotted, you see. But it was done, and they got away with it. But considering that our pay was half a crown a day, That's 17 and 6 a week. Plus half a crown clothing allowance. Because you bought your own clothes after your first kit issue. Now, out of that pound a week, you had an allowance to make home. Married men, of course. But if you wasn't, it was generally advised that you made one to your next of kin, which was 7 shillings. And if anything happened to you, your next of kin would have a claim on you for a pension if it was your mother. But if there was no allowance, there was no claim. So that left you with 13 shillings. That included clothing yourself, or buying your replacement of any kit you wanted, out of slops. So if you get a bottle of sure and get a pound, you was quite a rich man.
So your next of kin was your mother rather than your father?
Generally your mother. I don't know for why, but I think in most cases it was your mother. I know mine was to my mother, and I believe she had a book of some kind which she used to draw through the post office.
Were you better fed than the civilians in the war?
Not really, I don't think. The thing we never seemed short of was tea, sugar and milk. We'd always seem to have plenty of that. Food-wise, was short on that. Breakfast in the morning consisted of a woodbine and a cup of tea and a cough. You got the dinner, which was, say, meat, a few veg, and whatever veg there was, and potatoes. Bread. I can't remember whether bread was on a chit or not. But you got a couple of slices of bread and a layer of jam for what was counted as your tea or supper. And that was it.
Well, what was the proportion of hostilities only and regulars aboard the ship?
Well, I should think the HOs, hostilities only, would be about a quarter. Three quarters were either time-saving or R&Rs. And, VRs as well, volunteer reserves. Those were mainly officers with volunteer reserves. You could distinguish them by the rings on the sleeve. R&R was a zigzag. R&R was a straight
ring. And I lost track now. R&R was a straight ring. R&R was two rings looped. And R&VR was a zigzag ring.
That was a so-called Wavy Navy.
That's right, that was Wavy Navy. Plus the fact that we'd have the colours in between their bands, or on the sleeve, of which branch they belonged to. Doctor. Yeah, there was always lieutenants. They came in on their own qualifications. They were straight. They were left-handed straight up. I think theirs was scarlet. Paymaster was white. The engineer wanted a colour. I'm stuck up for that.
How did the reservists and the HOs and the regulars all get on with each other?
Well, on the first ship, not very well. You was made to feel that you were the amateur and the hostility only rating. They were only gradually beginning to accept that they required the HOs to man the number of ships that was coming out. It was a bit of a push, in other words. They suffered us in silence.
Were you treated with contempt?
Not open contempt, but you were made to feel the difference. You didn't speak to an officer unless he spoke to you.
Did you have much to do with the officers, or was it mainly the petty officers you dealt with?
Petty officers and chiefs, petty officers. They were the main men that we dealt with. Or dealt with us, I should say. They were the ones who gave the orders. And whatever work required doing, wires replacing, splicing and all that type of work, they gave the orders. They received from Jimmy the One, that's the second in command. He would give, we want this doing, we want that doing, to the chief buffer. That's the senior chief petty officer on the upper deck. And then he would relay the orders to his POs, and they would carry them out then.
What did you think to the officers and petty officers?
Some were all right. Some weren't. He just made the best of it. There was a war on.
Did they seem competent?
The time-saving men were. Because most of them had come up from boys. They joined at 14 and 15. So they were very competent. They really knew their particular job.
Who was the captain of the Cairo?
C.C. Ardy.
What was he like?
He was a foreign captain. I saw very little of him. I don't think I ever spoke to him, or he ever spoke to me. I had no contact with him at all.
Did the hostilities only and the time-serving men and so on have nicknames for each other?
Oh, yes, there's quite a number of nicknames on the mess deck. I can't just think about it off that.
But, I mean, would it be hostility only as a group, but you have a nickname from the time-serving men, or the time-serving men have a nickname as a whole from
you? No, you were intermingled, so you got on better on the mess deck than you did with the above.
What were the first duties that Cairo was involved in when you were on her?
We sailed from Plymouth, and we went up to Greenock. And from Greenock, we took on a delegation of Russian...
politicians?
Well, yeah, I suppose they were politicians. They'd been over here on a visit. And we took them on board, and of course they lived with the officers. And we took them from there to Murmansk and Rostov in Russia.
Murmansk and where?
Rostov.
How do you spell that?
I believe. R-O-A-S-T. You'd have to look that up. I can't...
Was this in a convoy?
No, we went on our own. We did a dash through on our own to take them back to Russia. We were returning home. We got through all right, with no problems. I was in Russia about a week.
Did you go ashore?
I went ashore.
In Murmansk?
In Murmansk, yes. There was very little to see.